Kala se guaha sana ke asuka. Chataha, kaiwaha, go wedineha, wedineha, go to a sanle. Anjadit neche, sanle. Richard Ground say safety. Cushing Haiti, budget. Seminoleha, zetyada, uchiha, zetyada. Zetyani, kala se guaha, go teshahale. I'm greeting you in the Yuchi language and expressing appreciation for hearing our languages here. This is really a pretty special event. I don't know how well we can frame and communicate to you the dynamics of the situation that we're in, but we're hearing from our elders here at this meeting, from Julian's parents, speaking their original languages, their first languages. And they represent an entire generation out of the nearly 200 languages, indigenous languages, original languages, still spoken in these United States, within the political boundaries of the USA. In almost all cases, it's essentially the World War II generation, the folks who grew up during that time and went off to war, that continue to carry the language. And I appreciate what our elders had to say to us, hearing those rich languages. This was their very first language. This was what their mother spoke to them. And that's why they speak it to you. But that time, that process has been broken, has been crushed through a very ugly, sordid, intentional colonial process that's been carried out for generations, in some cases, hundreds of years. And I can tell you now that I'm absolutely amazed anywhere I go in what some people call Indian country to hear these languages still spoken. It's incredible after the assault on our communities that anyone still speaks these languages. But what you're hearing now is the last of that original line of first language speakers. I'll give you a context. Within the state of Oklahoma, I want to welcome you to Oklahoma. This is the state that the publicity department calls Native America. This is the state where 25 languages are still spoken, indigenous languages. Out of those, only four are possibly being learned by children. Only four. All the rest are only spoken by our elders. And along with that, as has been suggested, along with that language, along with having the privilege of speaking the original languages, comes an enormous storehouse of knowledge, of history, as was suggested earlier, knowledge about medicines, plants, the land, the animals, all of that. But it's been under assault. It's been under extreme and direct attack for generations now. So that process is finally, after these many, many generations, bearing its final consequence. So that at the other end of the scale, the reason I'm trying to set this context is that the words you heard from my daughter, from Renee, speaking in the language of my grandmother, is extremely unusual. Every community all over Indian country, if you go and talk to them, with just a handful of exceptions, are counting down How many speakers do we have left this year? And we can look right around here, Caddo country. I would say less than 10 speakers. Up the road here, to the north, the Pawnees, less than 5 speakers. In the Yuchi community, we have less than 5 elder speakers who are fully fluent in the language. The Sauk language among the Sac and Fox over here on the other side of Oklahoma City, less than 10 speakers. And we can go on and on, but the point being that somehow we have to start counting forward again. We have to start adding new speakers to our communities to carry on our knowledge, to carry on the indigenous richness that the Creator has given us. Our elders often tell us, the Creator gave us our languages. That's the origin of, that's the source of, that's how the old people talk about it. And we believe that we're, shall we say, about the Lord's business in passing forward, in revitalizing, and in restoring our languages. So it's a little bit of an awkward thing to say, to hold up my daughter and for recognition, but in our communities all over the state, all over Indian country, it's the most difficult challenge to get young people to speak their language. It's not a small task. The natural progression is simply, if the mothers talk to their kids, you got it. But that's been broken up. And you heard the hint, the bottom line this morning, that people were convinced after being punished in school, after getting in trouble, the whole social message and the direct, many times physical experience of the problems associated with speaking your language, like my grandmother who grew up about 150 miles from here in Oklahoma, south of Sepulpa, Oklahoma. She only knew Yuchi language, didn't learn English until she went to boarding school, Yuchi Mission in Sepulpa. And she was too old. She was in her teens when she went. And they couldn't really make her lose her language. They didn't stop her. They didn't, the washing out of the mouths wasn't enough to brainwash her entirely from actually speaking her language, but it did brainwash her from passing that language on. So my father didn't speak. And it's the kind of the situation that Julian Judd was describing. So I talk about these things. I mean, it's a very awkward thing. I want to welcome you. I want to embrace you. I want to say, it's really good to see all of you here. But I also think we need to get straight about how we got here, how we got in the trouble that we're now in with our languages. So that's why I'm saying it's a very special moment to hear our elders speak and to hear a young person also speaking the language. Not because it's something she learned growing up immediately, but it's something that we still have the possibility of intervening, of doing something to keep our languages alive and pass them forward to younger generations. And that's happening all around. Different Native nations are starting to make that effort. It's extremely challenging. It's extremely rewarding. But just on the face of it, without going into the details, if you can imagine, if in almost every case, except for 4 nations here in Oklahoma, out of the 25 languages still spoken, the speakers are in their 70s and 80s and 90s. So it's very difficult to get that knowledge that they carry to young people that you want to come up and pick up the language. So just right on the face of it, you see the major challenge. But I wanted to try to set for you a little bit the colonial context. And I want to talk a little bit about it, not because I'm trying to be harsh, not because I'm trying to turn up the guilt factors, but I think that when we talk about the struggle for our languages, we need to be clear about the situation that we're in. And the popular notion with the loss and struggle that our languages are facing, the popular notion, it runs parallel to the assault on our communities, that somehow Native nations are weak, they are inept, they don't have capacity, they're not designed for the modern world, these kinds of notions that are a product of the colonial heritage that was deployed specifically as a means to justify the dispossession, to justify the assault on communities, the direct efforts to destroy the languages. In the shortest form, the most effective instrumentality in destroying our languages were the boarding schools. Government-run and church-run boarding schools were the kind of on-the-ground place where young people were taken out of their home, an intentional program. The reason they were boarding schools, just to spell it out, was to get them out of their homes, get them away from the elders, get them away from the folk who knew their songs. They didn't want them to learn their ceremonies. They didn't want them to speak that language anymore. That's why it was a boarding school. So they would be gone for months, many times years on end, so that that chain of continuity would be broken. So it was a form of racism and discrimination that was incredibly expensive. By today's dollars, millions, I don't have the actual math, I would guess billions of dollars were spent destroying our languages, breaking down our ceremonial ways, assaulting our traditions that have been passed down from time immemorial. That's kind of the big picture in the kind of the shortest form that I can put it. What I want to do today is talk a little bit about the colonial context. And before I do that, I need to be clear about how much time we have, or what's our time frame. I'm sorry. The clock on the back says 10 till 3. And I don't want to wear everyone out, but okay. Okay. Well, I want to talk a little bit about the colonial context to kind of set up the frame. And I want to talk about it in terms of kind of the early hints and then the ongoing pattern and the extraordinary longevity, the extraordinary way in which the old colonial ideas and notions that were used to facilitate the destruction of the assault on indigenous nations, the attempted destruction of their ways of life, those early notions, I think, are still alive, very much alive, are still very much with us. And I kind of want to talk a little bit about that. What I thought I might do is begin with the founder of Methodism, as I imagine most of us know in the room. John Wesley came to what was considered, referred to as the New World, came to the Georgia colony, to Savannah, 1835. And while there, he met Creeks, so-called Creeks, Muscogee people, met Chickasaws, in fact, in one of his letters. Confesses that his intention, if he can find the time, would be to learn the Chickasaw language. He met a few native leaders from the nations in the area who came for trade purposes or negotiations. And in fact, of course, as we know, that was his main purpose for going, was to missionize the native nations. Oglethorpe, the governor, felt like they needed his services in the European-based colony, and that never really materialized. But the interesting thing was that, from my perspective, the remarkable thing was that John Wesley wrote really ugly things about these Native nations, about their beliefs, about their social practices, about their the way that they conducted themselves. The Muscogee Creeks, do we have any Muscogees here amongst us? Okay, well, I hate to tell you, John Wesley, you know, wrote that the Creeks were liars and cheats and, you know, really pretty mean-spirited things about them. But he really saved his most cruel remarks for the Yuchis, and said that the Yuchis killed their own children, things that were not really true, and things that he didn't really have a basis for making the claims. But I call attention to it now because I think it points to the ways in which the church historically has been complicit in the logics of dispossession, the colonial notions that underlie the very ugly history that I'm referring to. And I just spent a few days ago, some time talking with Keeper Johnson, who's the great-grandson of one of the people that was of Yuchi Jim, as he was referred to back on the rolls of 1832, 100 years after John Wesley was here saying these mean-spirited things about Yuchis and others. The colonial process in what is now the states of Alabama and Georgia, what we refer to now as the Southeast, then it was referred to as the Southwest, but they started a process that historically is referred to as the removal, a process that is sometimes referred to as relocation, and we're kind of stuck with this terminology. To talk about a removal sounds like perhaps a clinical process. To talk about a relocation it echoes with, you know, folk that work for a corporation that's now relocating them to Dallas, and, you know, they provide a van, you know, to set them up, transportation and, you know, moving van. And, but these were very ugly processes. Essentially genocidal processes that resulted in enormous loss of life, so that the Cherokees lost something over half their population, not just on the so-called Trail of Tears itself, but even after arriving, the deaths continued because they didn't have supplies, they didn't have the means to provide for themselves. These were essentially very ugly, brutal processes. And the one of the resistors to this process, when push came to shove, was this Jim Henry, was his English name. And if you look at the 1832 removal rolls of Parsons and Abbott, there is under one of the Yuchi towns that's listed is Jim Henry. And he had actually gone to Asbury training school in Alabama. And but once the push came, he joined with the indigenous resistors and participated in the burning of Roanoke, a community kind of in the central east side of what's now Alabama, and eventually then was removed in chains out to what was to become Oklahoma, arrived at Fort Gibson, and then later became a Methodist circuit rider, became a preacher, and helped start Broken Arrow Methodist Church, that's part of our Oklahoma Indian Missionary Conference. and other churches, and changed his name through that process and became known as James McHenry. So I'm referencing this kind of linkage to say, through all of that process, maybe it shouldn't be a complete surprise, even though there were Muscogees, there were Creeks, there were a lot of Choctaws, Chickasaws, who embraced the Christian faith, the new faith that was being offered prior to the removal. The pattern was an extreme revival with extremely high numbers of conversions going on. And that was all predicated to a significant extent on the hope that if we become Christians, if we come brothers and sisters with the folk who are here to remove us, maybe we'll get to stay in our land. Maybe they will treat us right. Maybe we will have the opportunity to stay. Many of the churches were empty after they made this horrible trek, this deadly march out to what was to become Oklahoma. So Muscogee Creeks had churches in their communities when they made that transition. Yuchis, who were removed, as it's referred to, so-called removed along with the Muscogee Creeks, hadn't on the whole converted to Christianity. It would not be really till the turn of the last century, somewhere in the late 1900s, that Yuchis as a community began to embrace Christianity. So I mentioned that in terms of maybe it's, even though of course Yuchis didn't read the notes that the words that John Wesley, the founder of Methodism, had written, yet perhaps it should be no surprise that Yuchis didn't really convert to Christianity until another 100 years after, almost 100 years after this removal process, so-called removal. So I'm trying to give you a little bit of a hint of the colonial context. And I'm referencing it in terms of the kind of ugly history that happened. It's not particularly comfortable to talk about. It's not particularly a great thing to recognize. But the logics of dispossession, the notions that underlie and justified the process of claiming the continent were deployed 300 years ago, 200 years ago, and seem to have this amazing staying power. So I just want to give you a few quick remarks as briefly as I can about that context. The general notions were included things like the peoples were comprised of weak nations. They were followers of religions that were not acceptable. There was a whole range of rationales that were commonly deployed. But the claim that was made by the colonizers was essentially that the entire continent should belong to people of European heritage, to followers of the Christian God. And this was not only a popular idea, not only a broad cultural idea, but it also found its way into actual legal form. And I just wanted to give you a reference to give you an idea about what is referred, what we can call perhaps the doctrine of discovery. And I hope it's not too laborious, but I want to give you a little bit of a sense of how seriously people took the rationales, the justifications for the assault on indigenous peoples. And I particularly want to bring this out because part of our time context here with this meeting, to remind us, this is the weekend that will be celebrated. This is the weekend that we'll be celebrating Columbus Day, recognized on Monday. So this is part of our context here. And I want to give you a sense of the actual legal basis for the European claim to all the land that you see here. It's a very strange circumstance, the legal consequence of which is that indigenous nations are not recognized as the full owners of the land. So if you go, if some of you may have been to Navajo land, according to U.S. legal doctrine, the Navajos don't own Navajo land. It's not really theirs. That's why it's called a reservation, because it's being held in reserve by the U.S. government on behalf of or for the Navajo people. It's the same as there are tree reserves or other kinds of areas that are set aside. And I just want to give you this U.S. Supreme Court decision in 1823, Johnson and Graham's lessee versus McIntosh, in which this doctrine of discovery was spelled out by the Chief Justice Marshall in this summary of why it is that Europeans claim the title to all this land. On the discovery of this immense continent, the great nations of Europe were eager to appropriate to themselves as much of it as they could respectively acquire. Its vast extent offered an ample field to the ambition and enterprise of all, and the character and religion of its inhabitants afforded an apology. The character of its inhabitants and the religion of the inhabitants afforded an apology for considering them as a people over whom the superior genius of Europe might claim an ascendancy. So this is the hierarchy of superiority, inferiority being spelled out. The potentates of the old world found no difficulty in convincing themselves that they made ample compensation to the inhabitants of the new by bestowing on them civilization and Christianity. So this is the what I call the great exchange. This is one of the fundamental justifications for taking the land, is the religion of the people. If we can convert them to Christianity, then it's a fair exchange. And this was throughout the colonial period, but it's here being spelled out at the Supreme Court, the highest decision-making body of the land. But as they were all in pursuit of the same object, the different European powers, it was necessary, in order to avoid conflicting settlements and consequent war with each other, to limit the amount of warfare between the European powers, to establish a principle which all should acknowledge as the law by which the right of acquisition, which they all asserted, should be regulated as between themselves. So this is the principle upon which the various European powers are to agree to their rights to this land. This principle was, I'm not making this up, I'm reading it right out of the Supreme Court decision. This principle was that discovery gave title to the government by whose subjects or by whose authority it was made against all other European governments, which title might be consummated by possession. So there's the actual legal basis or the claim by the U.S. government to all this land, that they're basing it on the earlier colonial powers who said, we found it, so it's ours. That's the actual basis. In the establishment of these relations, the rights of the original inhabitants were in no instance entirely disregarded. We're not completely ignoring the rights of the indigenous peoples, but were necessarily to a considerable extent impaired. So we've lessened their rights, their claims. They were admitted to be the rightful occupants of the soil with a legal as well as just claim to retain possession of it and to use it according to their own discretion. So if indigenous people are on the land, they can continue to use it, but their rights to complete sovereignty as independent nations were necessarily diminished, and their power to dispose of the soil at their own will to whomsoever they pleased was denied by the original fundamental principle that discovery gave exclusive title to those who made it. So I kind of take the time to spell this out by way of saying these are the colonial logics of dispossession. This extreme notion of superiority and inferiority. This deep-seated belief that the religious beliefs and practices of indigenous people are of no consequence. This whole range of ideas about civilization versus savagery was the language of the time. Now what has happened since then is that we've tried to clean up the language. We have tried to stop referring to the savages. We have tried to stop using a lot of the more abrasive language that carries the justification that were spelled out during the time that the actual assaults were going on. So in the big picture, I won't try to take the time to track the entire pattern, but I will just spell it out in these terms. Not that there's anything unknown or hidden about the reality that I'm referring to, but it's just not confronted very directly. It's not acknowledged, it's not recognized. And that is, the entire landmass bounded by the continental United States and its land claims currently, every major area of expansion of the USA was carried out by some form of genocide in order to gain control over resources, in order to gain access to lands, timber, water, that to implement those claims in every major region involves some kind of direct killing of massive numbers of people. And this wasn't just a single instance or a single generation or a single region. This is, when you look at the big picture and follow it systematically, it begins early. Let me just ask a little bit in terms of our awareness of some of these events. Can I ask, maybe for a show of hands, how many of you are familiar with the Jamestown Massacre in 1622? Okay, so that's a very, very high percentage, I would say. The 1637 Mystic River Massacre of the Pequots up further north, a few of you are familiar with it. And of course, everyone's familiar with the Sand Creek Massacre, 1864. The way the history books typically talk about it is as if these were extreme cases, as if these were almost by accident, as if officers or troops got out of control and something unusual happened. But if you actually track the pattern, it's consistent. Every major area of expansion is where this happened. So I'm trying to welcome you to Oklahoma, up, I think this way, the Ouachita, on the Ouachita River, not far from here, was James Armstrong Custer's massacre. That occurred here in the state of Oklahoma. We have massacres on Sapa Creek in Kansas. We have the Marias in Montana. We have of course, ultimately, this whole series of massacres that ends with the Wounded Knee slaughter in 1890. I'm referencing this to give us a context and to say that these patterns of assault were extreme and extensive. And at the same time, it's not something that we've been very good at acknowledging in within the USA. I was very pleased to hear my daughter say some words to you in the Yuchi language. And I have to tell you that some of you have maybe heard me mention this before, but when I was a graduate student at Princeton Theological Seminary, I began finding these reference volumes on Native Americans that said that Yuchi people were extinct. Publications, dictionaries, formal reference materials from 1979. I found it in 1881. I traced it clear back to 1827. Records, statements, claims, that the Yuchi people are extinct. References that our language is either extinct or almost gone. The most recent publication I've seen, and I haven't checked it real recently, is 1994. I have found references on the World Wide Web that speak about Yuchi as extinct. I mention this because this is part of the justification for taking the land, taking the resources, taking the continent, is to say, hey, these people are just disappearing anyway. You know, they're kind of melting away. And of course, the old logics during the 19th century was the height of what, of course, referred to as manifest destiny. So the assault on our communities in the broadest brush was first to come for resources. The colonial project is essentially about what we refer to as colonialism, is to take other people's resources to service your own interests. It's taking the richness of others in order to build your own wealth. It was a fairly ugly process. In the context of the United States, it was done under the name of U.S. expansion, a lot of patriotic fanfare, often with a Christian a veneer over it. The basic logic was, the most fundamental notion of the colonial project is, if it's Indian, it's ours. And I believe those notions are still very much alive today. If you doubt it, some of you I hope have been out there, you know, show up at a local school board and question their right to use a native-derived name for their mascot, for their team. You know, show up at a picket line at a college sports team where they use Native American mascots, and you'll be reminded that people really believe they've got a right to it. It's not, it's no longer just the resources, it's no longer just the land, it's literally the names, it's literally the identity, it's literally, in many cases, the spirituality that people feel they've got it. I mean, there's nothing more basic than that. And I think what's happening is, through the mascot activities, we're inculcating to a new generation, the children that are coming up behind, those same mentalities, those same beliefs about the right to everything Indian is still being reinforced. And you can track it in terms of our languages. The assault on our languages has been going on for many generations. so that we have not only the diminution of the numbers of speakers, but it's all the knowledge that goes with it. We had I'll just give you a couple of quick examples. We had at our little Indian Methodist Church, Pickett Chapel, we had a language camp for our young people. And one of our elders, beloved elders, Mose Kawi Shena, took one afternoon to tell the young people for the first time in the English language, which is the only thing they knew how to speak, what he had heard from the elders when he was growing up. He was raised by his grandmother, who of course didn't speak English, and he had the privilege of hearing the old stories about the so-called removal, this clinical process. And he told the young people about the soldiers taking the babies and banging them against the trees, cracking open their heads, these ugly things that hadn't been said in English. If you wanted to know those stories, you had to speak your language, because they were not spoken in the language of the colonizers. It was guarded in that way. And if he hadn't decided at the age of 82 that he finally was going to talk about these things, we wouldn't have known. The rest of us would have been left only with the stories as written in the history books. And that's what Mose told us. He said, what I'm going to tell you isn't in the history books. What I'm going to tell you hasn't been written down. It's not in the English language. But here's what happened. And this is what they told us. So our languages are the key to this storehouse of knowledge, this continuity with the past. And yet, after generations of direct assault on our languages through the boarding school systems, now our latest challenge, and I won't spend a great deal of time on it, but you know, now we have the English-only push that comes about every legislative session to the state of Oklahoma, in which it's this wondrous vehicle in which they manage to really never name their intended targets, but the collateral effect of the English-only push is that it impacts our indigenous languages as well. It creates this ugly climate of intolerance, of lessening the push, the need, the funding for keeping alive our indigenous languages. I think the height of this activity probably was around the year 2000 here in the state of Oklahoma. Some of us that work on language issues here in the state began hearing about discrimination against children who came to school speaking their languages. This was in Cherokee country, so there weren't very many children doing that, but of the handful who were, they were being discriminated against. And we worked with some of the legislators and got the Oklahoma Native American Heritage, the Oklahoma Native American Language Heritage Act passed in the early part of that year. By the later part of that year, the national project, promoted largely by U.S. English out of Washington, D.C., had been paying local petitioners to collect signatures to have a referendum process in the state of Oklahoma to make English the official language of the state. And so some of us were having to figure out, you know, how much time do we put into fighting this? And the reason that it matters, there are several reasons it matters, but one of the most important reasons is our biggest challenge, among many challenges, in keeping alive our languages is getting our young people jazzed about it, keeping them engaged. The social climate has been largely framed and defined, dare I say it, by Hollywood, you know, at a popular cultural level. Some of our young people, I don't know if I should say this in a public setting, Some of our young people would rather, and I say this with sadness, would rather go to a Boy Scout meeting and pretend to be Indian than sit down with their elders and learn their language and learn their ceremonies and learn their songs. Not to say that that's always the case, but we live in a climate in which what it means to be Indian is being promoted out of false programs that parallel the Hollywood impressions, that parallel the kind of false notions that our people have been living with for many years. So that our effort to keep alive our languages when something like English only comes to town has to do with trying to avoid the climate becoming any worse than it is. We want our young people to be proud of their languages. We want our young people to be proud of who they are as young Native Americans. And this is a, you know, makes the work more difficult. Some of the specific wording of these legislative acts can be especially difficult for Native American languages, particularly in the early phases. By this year of 2000, we have a former senator here in the state of Oklahoma, Seminole, Kelly Haney, who played a powerful role in the Senate. And three times when these proposals came into the Senate for the state of Oklahoma, he had the clout to bring it down. And the most dramatic case was probably about 1999 when he got out his Seminole Bible. He was a fluent speaker of the Seminole language and got out his Creek, his Muscogee language Bible, and began this kind of a filibuster process to prevent this vote from coming to the floor. And the other senators didn't have the heart to cut off the reading of the sacred text. And it kind of maybe gave a more complete meaning to what it means, you know, when the state motto is Oklahoma, Native America. Quite an amazing event. And the newspaper, the Oklahoma City newspaper, carried a picture of this warrior, you know, speaking his language, reading the text in order to hold at bay the English-only effort. Those are the kinds of challenges that we struggle with. Limited resources, extremely limited time. Our elders are the speakers of our language. The folks with the knowledge are no longer young people. And we're looking at how do we keep our languages alive? How do we keep them going? So that some of the notions about the demise of indigenous peoples, many of them build specifically on the idea that our nations are inept, they have limited capacity, and that's the same kind of logic that goes into the assault on our languages. Our young people absorb the idea that the reason that our languages are in the poor shape they're in is because, you know, our peoples are just culturally incapable of carrying it forward, that our languages couldn't stand up to the might of European onslaught. And we haven't been very clear about the actual direct assault on our languages. So that's the reason that I'm trying to frame a little bit for you the colonial context and give you some sense of the way that the early ideas that justified the dispossession, that justified the assault on our peoples, are still with us. Let me ask for a show of hands. Did any of you see the film New World? That was, some of you have seen it. If you remember in like 1992, the quincentennial, a lot of indigenous educators, a lot of Native American activists, took the occasion of the quincentennial to say, this ain't the new world. This is our world. This is an ancient world to us. This is not a new discovery. And, you know, that whole challenge against the kind of colonial logics that Columbus discovered a new world, which reflects a particular perspective. But what's striking is that this notion keeps coming around again. So now we've got the message didn't get through. I can talk about one of my daughter's history professors at Dartmouth who uses this as a theoretical model, the new world, which is a direct and explicit echo of the logics of colonial assault for hundreds of years, and yet it can easily just simply be dusted off and reappropriated, regardless of how many voices in 1992 were saying, you know, we need to move on, people. Recently, the film Pocahontas was redone again. Did anybody see this? Some of you did it. Kind of depends on what your connection is to your kids and grandkids and their age, probably. Why are we still telling that story of Pocahontas? I think it's about keeping alive the justifications for the dispossession and killing of tens of thousands of Native American peoples. That is to say, the Pocahontas story, in effect, is about a wizened young Native princess who could see the value, who understood the importance of European culture and lifeways and technology, and in fact, was willing to give her life. She loved. You know, I mean, this is the story that we hear. And we have to keep telling that story. And I'll just refer to it. I think the reason that we have to keep telling these stories, going back to the old logics of dispossession, reinforcing these notions, is because of our extreme overcommitment to a concept, an idea, an understanding of America as land of justice, America as land of freedom. People are dying right now overseas because of belief in that notion. It's very deep. It is fundamentally a religious notion, but that's another longer story. But it's so important to protect that idea that we haven't really been very good at getting straight about what has happened in this land. And that's why I'm mentioning that my people have been declared extinct repeatedly. That's why I'm mentioning some of this ugly history of assault, because I want to welcome you to the USA. And if I might, my understanding, when I think of the USA, you know, we had a Buffalo Nickel back when I was a kid. They were around in circulation. Well, they're bringing them back again. Now we've got Sacagawea recently on the dollar, you know, someone who was married to a person of European heritage to have children. You know, we've got that baby on the back. All of those images are there to kind of paper over that reality. We talked about the name of this state. Over half the states in the United States are named after indigenous people, native-derived names. That's a funny business. Where are those people themselves? Where are the Kansas people, after whom the state of Kansas is named? Where are the Alabamas? Where are the Tejas people, south of here? South? We live in a nation that has appeared to honor indigenous peoples while in fact visiting genocide upon them for generations, and followed it with what I think is properly cultural genocide, which involves the assault on our languages. And yet we don't want to really face it. We don't really want to deal with it. We would prefer to erase the Yuchis from the public record. It would just be simpler, you know. I mean, that's the ultimate justification, if the indigenous people would just go away. And that's why it's been so important to drag folks out of their home, out of their homes, away from their elders for generations. And that's also why, ultimately, when I think of the USA, I think maybe those letters stand for the United States of Amnesia, this is the place where we've forgotten. We've forgotten the history. You know, we've named our states after folk that we don't know who they are. We don't know where they are. We don't know what has become of them. And we certainly don't want to talk about the genocidal treatment followed by the physical genocide followed by cultural genocide that's been visited upon them. And instead, we paper over the whole ugly mess by perpetuating mascots that present caricatures, that present happy kind of red Sambo figures that you can see every Saturday in the college ranks and Friday nights all over the country as teams come out in kind of these faux pretend Indian buffoonery activities that go on. That is about denigrating, disregarding, disrespecting the culture, the tradition, all those symbols that are used with the mascots. The feathers are sacred. Black Legging Society puts a value on those lances. They're not toys. Drums, you know, whatever it is that's going on out there is a way, an actual ceremony that reinforces the dismissing of indigenous peoples and cultures in a most incredibly effective way, because we don't want to deal with it. And one of the silent consequences of this history of assault on our peoples is our languages. Many people say, oh, if I'd lived in the time of Andrew Jackson, you know, something should have been done to stop that so-called removal. Right now is when our languages are going down for the last time. If something isn't done, literally, if not only here in the United States, globally, the next 20 years will likely see the loss of half of the world's languages. In the United States, the next 20 years will probably see the loss of 70% of our indigenous languages, unless something is done about it. And this is the core, the heart of who our peoples are. This is the diversity, the alterity, that which is unique about our peoples is all carried and coded in those languages. So I just want to remind us of the kind of context in which we live and the challenges that we face, and do appreciate your time. We did receive funding support for our language work from the commission in the past. Sanlakiyasla was a great help, a big boost for us, and we continue that work. Sanlakiyasla.